thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
And also,
here's John Williams.
Little thoughts. I like to think of us as an equal thought thinker. Hi, it's John. It's 9-11. John Williams here, weekdays from 9 till 12 noon on WGN. Remember, on Facebook, I'm WGN King John. The Mincing Rascals podcast I host is called The Mincing Rascals. That's what they're called. And once again, on all social media, it's WGN King John. You'll find our daily news click, our web poll question of the day there. There's lots of news, big and small, today. Of course, the two articles of impeachment against President Trump are front and center nationally. The abuse of power and obstruction of Congress charges against President Trump. It's important. This whole thing seems like this sort of long, slow train wreck whose conclusion you know. And so it's easy to ignore this. And then at the same time, it's almost hard to look away. I'm somewhere in between, depending on the day. We'll continue to update you on the news of the impeachment proceedings today. But that's the first story this morning relative to that we have two articles, one abuse of power and the other obstruction of Congress. And then there's just a whole bunch of other strange little things going on in our world, too. I'm going to talk to Greg Kot and you in about 10 minutes about Juice WRLD. Is it weird to you that somebody whose impact in the world of music is so great and you did not know one thing about this person, and he's from Homewood Flossmoor, and your kids and grandkids know who that is, and they are as crestfallen as you were when one of your favorite artists died at a tragic young age? That's Juice WRLD, whatever that is. It's the, you know, name that that young man used. And the details around that story now are unsettling, too. So Greg catches us up a little bit with that. Last night, I was on USA Today's website. Front story, the first story, Juice WRLD, dead at the age of 21. You know that as you get older, you lose touch with what the cool music is. And then every now and then you have this moment where somebody wins a Grammy or dies young, and you didn't even know they existed. At least you didn't know or appreciate their music.
That's how I feel when I watch the Grammys.
Oh, my gosh. And it's like, that's who? Not being dismissive. That's just life, you
and
know.
And then after you watch them, you feel like, wow, I know who Lizzie is.
That's why, me. Right, Lizzo.
Lizzo, sorry, I don't know who Lizzie is.
That's exact. And that's okay, too. I mean, that's just life. Music is most important to you when you're 14. And you're having your first crush, and there's a song on the radio, and that's how you associate your feelings. So I don't think you have to apologize for any of that, but it's also no reason to look away. So Greg Kot says hi to us in just a few minutes about that. And our news click, real quick, the daily web poll question. American Airlines refused to board a woman until she took off her Hail Satan t-shirt. Established in the year 666, it said underneath. Isn't that funny? Dave, I'm putting you, when I become king, in charge of passengers on airplanes. Does this lady get to board with her Hail 666 Satan t-shirt?
I mean, I think it's kind of hard to deny people the rights of freedom of speech, or in this case, I guess, freedom, as Steve said, freedom of expression on a t-shirt.
Yes.
I don't know. Unless there's something specifically threatening. I mean, that's a perceived threat, but I don't think you could say, they're not saying, I'm going to do something bad
well,
to the people
it.
On this plane.
That's my thought, Dave, was as long as the person wearing the Hail Satan t-shirt isn't flying the plane, if the pilot goes, right. Hey, welcome aboard, woohoo, and he's got a Hail Satan 66, then I don't want to get on that plane. I seriously don't want to get on that plane. Yeah. The person sitting next to me, I think I'll just have another cocktail and look out the window.
Yeah.
I don't love that shirt. I would ask my children to take it off. But I think they get to wear it. Mary, are you on page with us on that? I think so. We're reasonable people.
Yeah.
And I'll just remind you of the ye olden days when airlines used to require you wear a shirt and tie and a jacket to get on
I still dress up for flights. It's 9:15.
Oh, I'm flying tonight. I'm not dressing up.
Do you wear pajamas? Because you sit next to people that do that these days.
Dave, not dressing up as a pair of cords.
Okay, man.
I take prescriptions to make me feel okay. I know it's all in my head. I have these lucid dreams where I can't move a thing, thinking of you in my bed. You were my
9:20 now, WGN on Spotify. Almost a billion streams of this song by Jared Higgins. The world knew him as
I'll do it over again. I didn't want it to end.
Juice WRLD. Graduated from Homewood Flossmoor in 2017. 21 years old. Called by singer Halsey the fastest brain in the game, according to Megan Crapo and Rosemary Sobel's story in the Tribune today. When his plane landed at O'Hare, or rather Midway over the weekend, a private jet, agents were waiting for him, tipped off that there might be something on there, and turns out there were dozens of bags of marijuana, there was Percocet and codeine, there were guns with armor-piercing bullets. 21-year-old rapper seized up while he was there. They administered Narcan to him, revived him, but he died at 3:14 in the morning. Greg Kotz, the music critic at the Chicago Tribune, and joins us now and again on WGN. Hi, Greg. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, John. How about yourself?
Pretty good. What first struck you when you heard this story, Greg?
Well, sadness, shock. 21-year-old guy at the height of his career. Had just in the last 2 years really, emerged as a major commercial success as well as a critical success, and doing it on his own initially. You know, like many of these rappers, they start out very, it's a very homemade kind of operation, and putting their music up on the internet and, building an audience through their own industry as individuals, without any support from a record industry. And he did get signed to a major label deal, but I just thought this guy had the whole world opening up in front of him, and then he's gone. It's a really sad story, tragic story.
And one that's played out before, right? I mean, it's a shame to see how difficult it is for some of these artists to escape the trap of drugs.
Well, it's not just drugs. It's, being a young African-American male in America is, let's put it this way. Your lifestyle is one of looking over your shoulder all the time because, death could be coming for you at any moment in various ways. Drugs, but guns and just, you're a target, police, whatever. It's not an easy life. You're vulnerable every minute of your life, and you have to develop this sort of steely exterior to sort of survive in this world. So people are talking about these kids as thugs, and they go, well, part of that is, environment. It's not that they were born this way. It was they were, raised in an environment which, was a kill or be killed kind of environment almost. And, I give Jared Higgins, a.k.a. In Juice WRLD, a lot of credit for rising up out of that situation and making something of himself and making some really great music that resonated with many people in his generation. So he was trying to dig his way out, and it's unfortunate. Sometimes these things, the grip of drugs, the culture that you grew up in sometimes doesn't leave you no matter how far away, how far your success carries you. And I think that was the case here. We don't know all the details. All these drugs and guns, we don't know how they got there, how he was connected to them. There's a lot more detail that needs to come out before we can start making real judgments about this guy. But my sense was that he was very transparent about the fact that he used drugs. Mm-hmm. He included those narratives in his songs, his struggles to kick these habits, to realize that they were destroying his life. He was trying to deal with it in a way that a lot of young people could relate, because he was being vulnerable. In hip-hop, especially years ago, it wasn't cool to be vulnerable. You had to be the tough guy all the time. And I think why a lot of young people could relate to what he was saying, he says, no, I am struggling. I am in pain. I am trying to work through this, and I'm not doing a really good job of it. And they love that honesty, and I think that's one of the things that he really brought to his music that was so disarming in a way, and why he had such a powerful impact on his audience.
Greg Kahn from the Chicago Tribune. I featured a little Lucid Dreams there. Give me just one other title maybe or two if I were going to click around today and listen to his music. What else should... And by the way, most of the music is explicit. You'll see that warning on there. Hello. Welcome to 2019. But what else should I listen for? What are songs that represent his work pretty well?
Well, you know, there's a his last album that came out this year, Death Race for Love, debuted at number one on the pop charts. It's probably going to get, you know, it would have led to a big arena tour in the U.S. Next year. There's a song on it called "Emotions," where he talks about, you know, male emotions, you know, the whole idea of what it means to be a drug user and how he was trying to fight off this addiction and why he was addicted in the first place. I mean, he gets into a lot of heavy psychology. There's a new song, a new old song, I should say. It's it was officially released by his record company. It's called "Let Me Know, I Wonder Why Freestyle." That literally came out a day before he died. It was a song that really kind of put him on the map for a lot of people a couple of years ago when he released it on the internet. A lot of, you know, you're asking how do people find out about this stuff now. A lot of kids aren't listening to radio for hits anymore. They're going to SoundCloud and digital platforms like that for music. And there's this whole genre called SoundCloud rap that Juice WRLD emerged from. Let Me Know was initially released on SoundCloud. It got millions of hits there. Record company couldn't avoid it. 2 years later, it's still resonating and has become a hit all over again. This was even before he died, and now it's probably going to blow up even bigger. But the to me, what kills me about that song, the "Let Me Know" chorus, it's just a recurring phrase. The sadness, the forlorn quality of his voice in that song, you can sort of relate to, like, here's this kid trying to be a tough kid, you know, and make his way through the world, but he's just sad and he's despairing about this whole idea of, you know, this ex that you know, and this relationship that will never be.
Yeah, when I was listening to some of his music myself in the last 2 days, and forlorn, transparent, a kind of honesty, I was certainly picking that up. Greg, I'm out of time this morning, but you're always kind to join us, and I sure appreciate your thoughts and expertise today.
You're welcome, John. Always a pleasure to be on.
Greg Kahn from the Chicago Tribune. You know, we haven't done this in a while. I don't even know where our red kettle is, the virtual John Williams kettle at WGNradio.com. Producer Olive, look that up for me in a minute, will you, please, and tell us how much money we have in our virtual kettle. It's easy to donate to the Salvation Army. Go to WGNradio.com on the John Williams page. You can make your donation there and help the Salvation Army do the most good. Hey, are you hosting for the holidays? Get your carpets cleaned and looking new again. Call now and you'll be scheduled before Christmas. Executive Green Carpet Cleaning is the best value in town. Their unique process leaves your carpet cleaner, softer, and drier. You get three rooms done for just $139. Call 630-990-8600, 630-990-8600, or schedule online at executivegreencarpetcleaning.com. Happy holidays from your friends at Executive Green Carpet Clean. By the way, Producer Aleph, where is my virtual kettle, please?
$3,185, John.
Hey, that's not bad. We're over 3,000. Whoop, whoop. What was the total again, please?
Did I stutter? $3,185, John.
Olive talks back to me sometimes that way.
I'm still on and I can hear you.
The Sun-Times has this story today. I was last night, Steve, you weren't able to go with us, but the Mincing Rascals had their little annual pizza party.
Is it an annual thing?
Well, this is the first one, okay. And I think we'll do it next year.
I was at my dentist's office looking at the added sugar chart.
Should have been with us. We were eating probably very sugary but delicious Lou Malnati's pizza at their new location, by the way. It's in the Wrigley Building downtown. Think about that. I was just talking to the manager there because I had some time before everybody arrived. There's like 55 Malnati's in the Chicago area. Only 10 of them are sit-in restaurants. When you think about it, there really aren't that many restaurants you go to eat Malnati's. You buy it frozen, or you pick it up or have it delivered and eat it at home. But they do have one location now on Michigan Avenue downtown. Otherwise, you had to go to the Gold Coast to find one in the city, right? So they have one in the Wrigley Building. It's on the north side. So we took a corner booth there and had some pizzas and beer. And while we were talking, the Mincing Rascals, a group of journalists and talk show host types, Justin Kaufman was there. Steve Bertrand was not able to be there. And I think it was, who was it? It might have been Lisa Donovan from the Tribune, who said that it surprised her at this city council meeting that they were going to mandate that they do attendance before a vote in the committees to make sure they had a legal quorum, right? You can't do the business unless you get enough people there to actually vote on something. But they never take attendance. They just vote on stuff. And I was kind of shocked to hear that. This is Franz Spielman's story in the Sun-Times today. Alderman Patrick Daly Thompson of the 11th was forced to withdraw his proposal for mandatory attendance before city council meetings. You would think that if you were on a city council committee and you were charged with doing something important to the city, that you would have to go. And if you're not there, there would be some official record of that. But they don't want that to happen. Was forced to withdraw his proposal for mandatory attendance before city council committee meetings. And a requirement he also wanted that half of all committee meetings be held at night after a barrage of opposition from his colleagues. Until the city council finally started live streaming committee meetings where the real business gets done, attendance was paltry. Even now that live streaming has shamed some no-show aldermen into attending, it's still not unusual for committees to vote on important legislation with only a handful of aldermen present. The legal requirement that a majority of committee members show up to conduct official business is routinely ignored. A quorum is assumed unless a committee member asks that attendance be taken, and that only happens when the alderman wants to block a vote. So if it's not going the way you want, just say, I move that we take attendance. There will never be enough people there, and then they can't do what they're doing.
So this is what you talked about during your pizza party for the Mincing Rascals?
Kind of. How's that dentist appointment looking now, Steve Bertrand?
Sweet.
On Monday, a standing room only crowd of roughly two dozen Chicago aldermen showed up at a rules committee meeting to snuff out an attempt to end those quote unquote good old days. I don't know if Lori Lightfoot knows about this, but she's your new no-nonsense sheriff. Lori Lightfoot does not put up with this nonsense, these shenanigans. Alderman Patrick Daly Thompson of the 11th, whose uncle and grandfather benefited from that old system, was now pushing a resolution requiring committees to take a vote at the start of every meeting. If no majority is present, he says, the committee would be required to adjourn on the spot. We don't have enough people to do business. And they said, no, we're not going to have it. And your Chicago City Council is not going to do it that way. Oh, that's just great. I think the Mincing Rascals will take this up. And that wasn't even the most controversial of the things. Even more controversial, says Spielman in the Sun Crimes, was Daly Thompson's proposal to require half of all committee meetings to be held after 6 p.m. to bolster public participation. And the other aldermen said, yeah, that's a good idea, but it's not really such a good idea. It's inconvenient for a lot of us. We've got long days, and so we don't want to do that either. So, two real simple. Boy, when I get to be king, Steve, you will have to have half of the meetings will be after 6 p.m. You go home, you have a sandwich, and then you run out and you go to the committee hearing or the city council meeting if you want. That seems to be a good idea. And we'll have a vote at the beginning of the committee meetings. And if half or more of us are there, then we can do business. But if there's 10 people on the committee and only three of us are there, it would seem to me like even my condo board couldn't pull that off. There's not enough people.
What if they're the three smartest ones?
Well, I think what they are is the most influential ones, or at least the ones that got the word from the influential people and the business gets done the way the boys downtown want it. Jim, you're on WGN. Why are you calling this radio station? Jim, hello.
Well, I got my knee story for you, John. I've been listening to you for 30 years in your previous life out in this desolate country of South Dakota. Anyway, yeah. I've got an ice pack on my sore knee. That was what I was going for, and an ice pack on my sore knee.
Oh, and a partridge on a pear tree.
And an ice pack on a sore knee. Right?
You got it.
Right.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for the phone call. I asked for puns, and now I'm sorry that I did, for the Joint Relief Institute commercials we were doing. I had a couple woven in there. God rest ye very painful knees. Thank you very much for that text. Okay, so after the news, Steve will do that here in just a second. We'll talk a little bit about those end-of-life decisions that you may have communicated to a loved one, but is that sufficient? Honest, when Brenda and I used to fly, I think we must have had a will, maybe we didn't, but it hadn't been updated in years, and I don't think we'd communicated exactly who we wanted to raise the kids or whatever money we had, where does that go? Or if we're in some sort of vegetative state, do we want to be kept on extraordinary life-sustaining measures, that sort of things. And it seems to me like maybe Brenda wrote a note out and put it in an envelope, or maybe we just dictated something to ourselves and wrote it on a sheet of paper. I don't know. Have you done something like this before? And I've wondered, would that hold up? Would a judge or a doctor honor that? Or if you simply communicated to that, if I knew somebody well enough that they told me these things, I would say they would never want to live in that kind of state. Would that be sufficient? What are the rules about this? And if the answer is no, then what are you and I doing about that? Let's get a little information about that after the news. Here's a topic that just won't go away. 608, I travel to New York City, John, for business often, and the Canadian goose cancer is uniquely Chicago. They mean the Canada goose jackets everybody's wearing here. It's jaw-dropping to see how sold out the city of Chicago is to consumerism, even more than New York. Keeping up with the Joneses is exhausting. After leaving Illinois, you realize it more and more. I didn't ask, but okay, I'll read that text. And John, I love my dog. I love other people's dogs, but they do not get to run errands with their people. I know a couple of people that are deathly afraid of dogs. Some are allergic. We have to respect other people's pets. Don't bring them into stores. I want to have a conversation with you about a story that's in the news on the front page of the Tribune on Monday. You may have seen it as well, and I've been referencing it a little bit on the show today, just to kind of get you ready for the conversation we want to have. Friends rescue couple facing tragic decision while abroad. Fundraiser allows Chicago man to come home and die. And Robert McCoppin's story begins this way. Megan Quinn and Andrew Marciniak met on the mountainside in Montana, where she washed dishes and he waited tables at a ski resort. When she served in the Peace Corps in Grenada, he followed her there. Intensely in love, friends said, they married at a chapel on a lake in Ireland. They settled in Chicago. But asked as they told friends, what if we lived a life in which we did exactly what we wanted? That life was built largely on traveling the world and teaching children of all abilities and backgrounds. This fall, the couple moved to Columbia to work as English teachers. But their adventure suddenly ended there when Andrew had a severe allergic reaction, stopped breathing, suffered permanent brain damage. Doctors put him on a ventilator but said he was unresponsive. It's weird, too, because this happened in Colombia. And I guess in Colombia, the law is, it said that hospital officials told his wife the Colombian law prevented them from taking him off life support. That was their wish, since he was not considered terminally ill. So he would be kept alive in Colombia. To bring him back to the United States would cost them $50,000, money that they were able to raise on a GoFundMe page. Their credit cards, in fact, had racked up more than $75,000 in medical bills. That's one part of the story. But the other thing is, she could have said, well, no, I know his intention, his wish was for him to be taken off life support. But in Colombia, they don't honor that. And I was wondering, how is that played out in the United States, in Illinois? Mary Pat, let's see if this phone line is a little better. Are you still there?
I am.
Good. This sounds terrific. So you know the story, and I just sort of set it up. What jumped out at you when you first heard about this story? I mean, you must see cases like this now and again, right?
Once in a while, not tremendously often, thank goodness. My heart just went out to them. That was just such a terrible, tragic circumstance for them.
Yeah.
You know, and then, of course, you think about, you know, and they couldn't have done anything. They did everything they could. But here in the United States, most states do have some sort of a health care surrogate act that might have helped in that situation.
What does that
even
mean?
Where you don't have. So there's a couple of different things. Here in Illinois, we have actually written attached directives that people can put into place. One is a healthcare power of attorney, where you actually get to name your agent to make your healthcare decisions if you're unable to do so. That form also allows you to specify what kinds of medical treatment you want and the circumstances under which you would want life-sustaining treatment to be withheld or withdrawn.
I see.
We also have a living will that you can execute that says that, you know, this would come into play if your agent can't or won't act. Says I can't if my condition is terminal, I don't want to be kept alive artificially. So those are written directives, but we also have something called the Healthcare Surrogate Act, and that would allow, even where you don't have a written directive, a physician to look to certain people in your life to make your healthcare decisions, including medical treatment, and under some circumstances, the decision to withhold or withdraw life support. There's sort of a hierarchy of people that you can name or that are named in the statute.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad, because too often I think it's frustrating. It sounds like the laws don't reflect the common sense that all of us would like to see. And I think a lot of us, if you're not older, maybe you haven't thought about these things. You haven't literally filled out some form. You may have had this conversation with your family, but you haven't really filled out a form per se. But in the absence of that, Illinois law says, okay, then we'll just ask your husband or wife or whoever that person is in the hierarchy, and they get to make that decision.
Right. Your spouse, then it goes to your adult children, then to your parent, then siblings, then to your grandchildren, and then one of the last people is the close friend, which is someone who's willing to give an affidavit that says that they're close enough to you that they know what your medical decisions would be.
Hmm. Do you recommend that people do just jot something down like this? I mean, would that matter to a court? Would that have any binding?
It would be helpful. I mean, the easiest thing to do is just download the forms. The Illinois Department of Public Health, they're free. You download them. You can print them off. They don't have to be typed up. You can handwrite them. Now, the healthcare power of attorney does have to be witnessed by one independent person, someone who's not named in the form and not responsible for your healthcare. But that's a very simple thing to do. If you can't do that, then yes, at least talk about it with your close family members so that everyone is on board. I mean, one of the problems with the Healthcare Surrogate Act is you can have more than one person in the category. For example, if you have two or three children and they don't agree on the parent's course of treatment, I mean, that can be problematic. It can cause a lot of conflict and pain at a very stressful time.
What happens in a situation like that?
Well, it's majority vote, but the one thing that can happen is if someone is disgruntled, they can go to court and try to get appointed as the person's guardian of the person, and the guardian of the person is the top preference, given top preference for making those decisions.
Well, I wonder if the ending of somebody's life means a financial windfall for some of these people. If the siblings might say, well, I know why you're so anxious to do this. You want to get to the estate, right? That's a possible scenario, right?
There's all kinds of possible scenarios when it comes to families. There's all kinds of terrible things people say and do, and that's why it's a wonderful gift, really, to write these things down, appoint someone who's going to make the decision you would have made for yourself or the best one possible, and talk about your decisions and your wishes with that person.
Well, without commenting on anybody's specific situation, if you're confident the person's never going to regain consciousness or any kind of life to be appreciated, what's the point of keeping them on some artificial life-sustaining apparatus?
You know, John, people's emotions run the gamut. And especially in a situation where, you know, you're looking at your parent or a child or something like that, where you can't conceive of life without them, sometimes it's very difficult to make that decision.
What was the case that was it in Indiana? A woman was, or Florida, she was, Ohio, where am I thinking of? Do you know the case? It was a woman, she was kept on life support for a very long period of time. The state was fighting with the family.
I don't know all the details of this case. I think you might be thinking of the Terri Schiavo case down in Florida.
Yeah,
she was a very young woman who had cardiac arrest at a young age, and she was not really on life support. She was conscious, but I don't remember all the details. But that was a very painful, and I believe it was actually her husband and her parents were fighting with each other.
Yeah, right.
Congress actually got involved and created a law.
Yeah.
I don't remember what it was, but
right. And you know, it seemed like she was responsive to things. But one, you know, and here again, I guess this is another conversation I would have with. It's hard to anticipate every eventuality, but I would say to my family, okay, so suppose I could live even without, well, I don't know, this is a different bailiwick, isn't it? If that's the life I'm going to live, I don't want to live that life, and I don't want you to have to live around me in that state. So even though I'm quote-unquote alive, I don't see the purpose of that. I don't suppose there's any means to end my life prematurely, though, right? We don't have anything akin to euthanasia in the state of Illinois.
Not in Illinois.
No. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Now, you may have a question or comment along these lines. Mary Pat Flaherty is on the phone line. This is what she does. And I've already got some text from producer Olive here. We'll answer more of your questions next. Mary Pat Flaherty is an attorney in Western Springs who does the kind of work we're talking about. That is, if you want end-of-life decisions made on your behalf, how do you communicate those to people? It was referenced in a story in the Tribune the other day, and I thought, well, how many of us have actually... I think, Mary Pat, a lot of us in passing would say, I know how my parents, my spouse, or my kids, my friends feel about this. I know them. But if I don't have some handwritten or typed-out form directing me, am I able to make a decision on their behalf? And again, if I understand correctly, you said, absent a written form, the courts in Illinois do then have a hierarchy of family and friends, and what was the order? Did you say that the spouse is first on that list?
So it's not just the it's really not the court. It doesn't involve a court. The physician himself or herself can look to these people. So you don't have to get a court involved. The hierarchy is the court-appointed guardian of the person. So if you already have been to court and have a guardian of the person appointed, that person would be. Otherwise, spouse, then adult child, then parent, then sibling, then grandchild, then close friend.
That's interesting to me that the parents aren't first. I understand why the spouse would be. I mean, that's a hell of a decision to have to make. You know, even legislatively, but all right, the husband or wife would be first. What about if you're partners but you're not married?
Well, I suppose you'd have to go all the way down to the close friend category for that.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a really important point. You know, if you're in a situation like that, you definitely need a written advance directive.
Teresa, you're
on power of attorney.
Teresa, you're on WGN. What can we do for you? Hi.
Yes. I have a question. I do have a will, but if I wanted to change the executor on the will, do I have to go back to the attorney, or can I do it myself and just initial it and a date and have it notarized?
It's always best to consult with the person that created the document. I mean, I don't know anything about your estate plan, but I always feel that it's better to involve an attorney if you involved an attorney to start with, or even if you haven't, because, you know, we're trained to look at circumstances that you might not be thinking about.
Interesting question. Thanks for the call, Teresa. I hope that helps. Chris, you're on WGN. What was your question or comment?
Yes, my comment. This is regarding the DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate orders. And
yes.
We found out the hard way that the DNR, thinking that this takes care of, you know, the end-of-life situation, and at the request of the person, my mother and my uncle were revived because of blood transfusions. And we were told that blood transfusions are not covered in the DNR. So my question is, if somebody in all good knowledge, when they're alive and well, signs that do not resuscitate order, comes into this kind of a situation where they're brought back by blood transfusions. My mother was very, very upset.
Oh, really?
She should have died in surgery. And when she found, when she woke up, she was very upset because she felt her moment had been taken away from her.
Hmm. What a strange story. Mary Pat, any comment on that?
Well, I mean, a DNR, or now it's called the physician order regarding life-sustaining treatment, that's actually between you and your doctor. So my understanding is if you, you know, and you're probably right that the standard form does not, might not say that. I'm not really that familiar with that because that's something that the doctor and the patient do together. My guess is that you might be able to specify that if that's your specific request. Also, anything that the patient has not specified on a DNR or POLSC, then your healthcare that falls back to the healthcare power of attorney. If you had specifically said on that form, I do not want blood transfusions, and somebody asked you, that's the thing. Here she is in surgery. Is someone going to come out of the of surgery and ask the agent? You know, it's hard to think of every possible, you know, scenario going into something like that, I think.
Yeah, but boy, that's, I guess, if you want to, choose to think about that. All right, suppose I die on the operating table and massive blood transfusions will keep me alive and maybe bring me back to life. It sounds like her mother was able to communicate. Maybe she wasn't happy with the state in which she was going to live afterwards. But if you don't want even that level of extraordinary measure to keep you alive on the operating table, you need to tell your physicians that. Is that what I'm hearing from you, Mary Pat?
Yeah, and you know, you really need to speak with a medical professional, because I'm kind of wondering to myself, not being a medical professional, if someone said that to me, I don't know, wonder if I'd even do the surgery. You know, but that's a medical professional's judgment.
Chris, thanks for the call. This is Joe. What can we do for you, Joe? You're on GN. Hi.
Hi, how are you? I have a question. It's kind of a sad situation. I was adopted 57 years ago. With loving parents and two brothers. My mother passed away a few years ago, and she was on life support, and seeing that my brothers took control of making the decision whether they should keep her alive or not, I disagreed. Then my brother passed away. Now there's just three of us, my brother, and my father, who was 96. And my question is, as an adopted person, do I have any rights or say-so in the situation of in my father's living and his estate as well?
As far as I know, an adopted child who is legally adopted is the same as a natural-born child for these purposes.
Yeah, I would sure hope so. Joe, were you legally adopted? Like, do you have papers or documents like that?
No, I wasn't.
So they adopted you, quote unquote, but not officially, not legally.
My mother was my aunt, and they adopted me when I was 3 months old. My biological father, couldn't take care of me.
Okay, so they raised you. They raised you as their son, but you were not that per se. Okay, Mary Pat, the plot thickens.
And so you're asking me whether you have any ability to make your father's health care decisions under this statute.
Right.
You know, and I've not run into this situation before, but my guess would be if you're not legally adopted, you might not have that same those same rights as your siblings who were natural born. Now, you know, your father, if he's still competent, can write out a power of attorney for health care, appointing someone to make his health care decisions.
Oh, that's interesting. So while the son may not, or this man may not be able to dictate that, his father could, as long as he's competent. His father could say, I want this person to be a decision maker for me, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. I hope that helps, Joe. And Diana, we're short of time here. What's your question, Diana? You're on the air.
Thank you. I just had a question about, I had a pulmonary embolism and was rushed to the hospital and they revived me twice. I was dead twice. I thought in my will there was something, I don't have it in front of me, about not maybe exactly do not resuscitate, and thank God they didn't, or they didn't know that because here I am. But is there specific wording that you should have in your will? Because I got to dig it out now that you're talking about this.
This is an
subject.
Yeah, no kidding. I've got just a few seconds left here, Mary Pat.
Okay, so by the time someone reads your will, you're already deceased. So you need to have an advance directive, a health care power of attorney that you sign that is effective during your lifetime.
I'm out of time. If you have questions like this, contact somebody like Mary Pat Flaherty. And you said that some of this stuff you can do on your own, too. You can go online, get forms, and fill some of them out for some of the basic stuff. Right, Mary Pat?
Yes. The Illinois Department of Public Health, if you search advanced directives on that website, all the forms will come up.
It's nice to talk to you, Mary Pat. Thanks for your help this morning.
Thanks, John.
Have a good day. She's in Western Springs. John, my husband and I update a letter and sign it every time we travel, and we keep all previous letters to show we have consistently done this. That in relation to our conversation before the news about have you expressed what your wishes are in case you're not able to speak for yourself? Do you want extraordinary life-sustaining measures? I think most of us would say no, and I think most of us know what our husbands, wives, maybe kids, parents would want. You've probably had those conversations. But maybe only as we get later in life. And in the case of this story in the Tribune this week, a couple was not very old, and suddenly they were facing that sort of situation. It was interesting that Mary Pat Flaherty said the things she did, particularly that even if you don't have it written down, if you can express what their intent was, and you're the person that the law recognizes as the first person to speak for them, that'll kind of do. And the order is the spouse, then the children by age, and then the parents. And then there's other gray areas, right? If you're sort of adopted but not officially. She said that adoptive children have the same right as the children that the people had. But she said, if you are living together as a couple but you're not married, then that makes it more complicated. Then maybe you should put that stuff in writing. Yeah, maybe we all should. And you don't have to hire an attorney to do it. You can simply download some forms or write it out as you wish. But there's forms that the state of Illinois has online. All right, that's all good to know. 11:09 now. Steve, you probably noticed in the news this week that young man who initiated the ice bucket challenge has passed away.
Yeah, I saw that yesterday.
You know how much money the Ice Bucket Challenge raised several years ago?
How much?
They estimate over $200 million.
Wow.
$200 million. Do you remember what a craze that was?
Yeah, I was going to say, and it's never been duplicated. I think they, tried to come up with other charities' ideas, but it was just a sort of serendipitous moment in our time.
Yeah, and you're right. Somebody else said, okay, now we're all going to do this. And that one had some legs but didn't take off like it did, and then it just kind of went away. It was a moment in time. And as I recall, the idea was I dump the ice bucket on me, but then I call out you and say, Steve Bertrand, I challenge you to do the same, right?
I think someone dumps it on you.
Right.
And then you challenge someone else. Remember Jonathan Taves?
No.
He was like skis right behind a boat, and they dumped him off the boat. They threw the ice on him. Remember that?
No, I don't remember.
I can't remember what it was. It was like a surfing board kind of thing being towed by a boat.
Yeah, right.
And they just tossed it from the boat.
I remember that the celebrities were into it. President Obama did it. Justin Bieber did it. Oprah Winfrey did it. And that you'd call somebody out equally famous, in their case, say. And that was pretty cool then to see if those other famous people would endure the ice bucket challenge. But then didn't you have to, I don't remember exactly how that turned into money, right? Like if I do that, do I have to raise a certain amount of money? I forget exactly how that worked out.
I think if you didn't do it, you were supposed to
pay.
That's
what it was. Yeah. Which is weird too, because it's easier to jump the bucket of water on your head maybe than to raise the money. Or I don't know what you're is easier for you, but it worked, whatever it was. We're going to talk to some people from the ALS after the 11:30 news a little bit about that story, but I have his name in front of me, and I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Pete, Frates, if it's Frates or Frates, Elif, thank you. Pete Frades, who raised millions for ALS research by championing the Ice Bucket Challenge, died at the age of 34. He was a really good baseball player, played for Boston College. He played professionally in Europe. He loved the game that much. Was in a fast-pitch men's league, I guess in Massachusetts somewhere. Took a pitch on the wrist. It didn't heal properly. They went in to get it checked, and it was then that they discovered it wasn't the beanball that hurt him. It was his ALS that was surfacing. And then he said, okay, I'm going to do something about this. A lot of nice things are being said about him and that challenge. And where are we on all of that? We'll step into that world a little after 11:30 on WGN. You know, Steve, we consume about 2.5 quarts of water a day.
That's almost as much as sugar.
Though we are not generally aware of it, because about half of the water that we consume is contained within our foods. Okay. Huh. I didn't know that, John.
Are you reading from the Bryson book again?
It's called The Body, Stephen. It says here, the conviction, this is one of the greatest dietary myths. The conviction that we should all drink 8 glasses of water a day is the most enduring of dietary misunderstandings. In 1945, somebody wrote a paper, and they said that we consume about eight quarts of water, or 8 glasses of water a day. And then people said, okay, well, then I need to drink 8 glasses of water a day to be healthy. That's about the amount of water you take in, because most of it comes from the food you eat and beverages and things like that. But the idea that, oh, I should drink a whole lot of water is not borne out in science. You're getting pretty much the water you need from the food and beverages that you consume. Some extra water is maybe not a bad idea. We should stay hydrated, but we don't need 8 glasses of water a day.
My eye doctor basically prescribed 96 ounces of water a day to me.
Like I said, we should drink 96 ounces of water a day.
So can I stop now? Because I have to go to the bathroom a lot.
I notice you've been doing that. And
did he charge you for that diagnosis?
I'm sure he did.
Yeah, prescription?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right, exactly. Well, he says that there's never any evidence that all of that water we're drinking is that much more beneficial for us unless you are severely lacking in hydration. And then he says this, one other enduring myth concerning water intake is the belief that caffeinated drinks are diuretics and make you pee out more than you've taken in. They may not be the most wholesome of options for liquid refreshment, but they do make a net contribution to your personal water balance. So if you're drinking soda or coffee because you want to get more water in, you will, in fact, have more water in you than what you eliminate. Thirst, curiously, is not a reliable indication of how much water you need. People allowed to drink all the water they want after getting thirsty usually report feeling slaked after drinking only 1/5 the amount they lost. Drinking too much water can be dangerous, Elif. In 2007, a young woman in California named Jennifer Strange died after drinking 6 quarts of water in 3 hours in a clearly ill-judged water drinking competition held by a local radio station. I think we were doing stuff like that here. I'm pretty sure Spike Odell used to do a contest like this with the on-air staff.
I was part of it.
They would drink water. You guys, was Dave part of it?
Dave the Camel Kaplan?
It wasn't me. I don't know.
I remember thinking, I'm not interested in that reindeer game. And I don't remember who won. But you did that, right? You guys drank a bunch of water to see who could hold the most. He's saying in this book, it's not a real good idea.
Isn't it comparable to drowning?
Maybe at a cellular level. I mean, that's what happened to this lady. She fell into a coma and she died. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's happened to other people, like a Georgia football player complained of cramps, downed 2 gallons of water and 2 gallons of Gatorade, fell into a coma and passed away. It's 11:15. All of this wisdom from The Body, the latest book by Bill Bryson. All kinds of random texts to the show this morning. Hey, John, says Nick, I almost bought into that Canadian goose jacket thing, and then I caught myself. I don't have that kind of money. $1,500? That's crazy. I also don't take the CTA. I drive everywhere. I could see maybe if you had to stand outside for long periods of time, but a $300 jacket would still do the job. And John, thanks for the informative segment with the attorney about end-of-life documents. My husband and I update a letter and sign it every time we travel. Oh, yeah, I mentioned this earlier, and we keep the previous letter to show that we've been doing this regularly. 630 said, I drank at least a quart of water every hour in boot camp. We were forced to, that is. And finally, 414, what book are you getting that sugar fact from? Sounds like a great Christmas gift. I've been sharing some anecdotes and thoughts and facts from Bill Bryson's The Body. That's the name of the book. It's a bestseller. It just came out. Hey, Gene, it's John Williams. What can we do for you this morning? Hi.
Hi, John. I wanted to call you about sugar as well as the water problem. Sugar causes five major degenerative diseases. And if you think about it, alcoholism affects the liver. Diabetes affects pancreas. The other one for,
You told Producer Elif something about water. What was your comment about the water we drink?
The water, there's a rule of thumb that you should drink half your body weight in ounces every day. Okay. And people who are not used to that will have to work into it slowly. Let's say increase it by 8 ounces the following week.
Wait a minute. I weigh 200 pounds. So if if you want me to drink 100 ounces of water.
And that is going to be difficult, but if you're eating... If you're eating fruits and veggies, that will give you your water supply. But coffee and soft drinks don't do it. They're toxic substances that will not do the benefit of water as water. There's nothing like water, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So if you, it is going to be difficult to drink, but you will notice an improvement. In fact, there's a book called You're Not Sick, You Need Water. And there's another one. Yeah.
What's that about? Well, so.
Same thing.
I think everything you said is true. That is, the stuff in coffee and soda, there's toxins in there. That's not all good for you. But this other guy was saying that you do increase your net water intake when you drink coffee and Pepsi. You shouldn't maybe drink Pepsi, but if you do, you will get water in you. So you at least got that going for you.
Well, coffee, if you're drinking a cup of coffee, you need two cups of water to replace that one cup of coffee.
This is not what he
said. I know it's not what he said, but that's not true that it's going to supply you what you need. It's not what you need. You don't need coffee. Your body wasn't meant to do that.
Oh, I need coffee. No, my body was meant to have coffee. Gene, what is the name of the book that you have there?
One is called You're Not Sick, You Need Water.
Right.
And the other one, oh my God, my brain went blank, but there is another one that preceded that. But you could get it in health food stores.
Yeah. That's very helpful. Well, I appreciate your listening, and thanks for those tips.
Good luck to everyone. Take care, Tom.
I thought
Jean just wants the best for us all.
I did the math at first, and I thought she meant ounces compared to pounds. So if you weigh 200 pounds
and you drink 100 pounds of water,
the number of ounces in pounds.
Yeah.
So for me, it was 1850, and I freaked out because I didn't think that was
well. But
right.
I think she said you get it in fruits and vegetables. I don't know how much I get from the apple or the orange or the banana, but that's mostly water. So I'm going to count that because this idea, it's her book versus my book. None of us are experts, but I'm just telling you, it sounds preposterous to me. That if I weigh 200 pounds, I'm supposed to drink 100 ounces of water, I don't get to count coffee or bananas, then that would be nine 8-ounce glasses of water a day.
Well,
I'm not going to do that.
Didn't you start by saying everyone says we're supposed to have eight?
Say it again.
Eight
oh yeah,
cups?
That's well. But
so that's
Bryson said that's kind of a myth.
I understand that, but if it's common wisdom,
right,
that's 64 ounces
right there.
So that's not that much more.
Okay, but my point was, I see your point, Steve. But so while maybe it's not that absurd, I'm still putting that in the old wives' tale. That's not you do not need to drink half of your weight in ounces in water.
Yeah, do you
don't even need 8 glasses of water a day.
Do you remember your parents ever walking around with water bottles or drinking water all day?
No.
I sure don't.
No.
And we didn't have air conditioning back then.
I mean,
people were sweating all the time. And they didn't drink that much water. Now, kids, they don't go anywhere without a water bottle.
No.
Yeah.
To me, I see people doing that, walking or jogging or doing whatever they're doing. And it strikes me as, for one thing, very inconvenient. I'm having trouble keeping my phone, my wallet, yeah, my backpack.
Got to remember a thermos now, your brush. Big water jug.
Elizabeth, you're on WGN. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Listen, I drank a lot of orange juice, and I thought that was enough.
Yeah.
I had an attack of dehydration like you never want to have. I couldn't move. I was screaming. They had to give me fentanyl at the hospital to relieve my pain.
Elizabeth,
yeah?
How much water should we drink? Do you have a feel for that?
I drink 6 8-ounce glasses at least. And every time my son calls me, he says, Ma, how many glasses?
Really?
Yes. That is nothing to fool around with.
All right. Okay, I'm going to stay as hydrated as I can. Now you're making me nervous here, Elizabeth.
I hope so.
Thank you for the call. Well, it appears as though tomorrow we're going to have to get a doctor on to talk to us about how much water we should be consuming because I was liking what I was reading. What's that sort of confirmation bias? It sort of supported my lifestyle, so I thought, those are the true facts.
Makes perfect sense. Well, I believe Bill Bryson and his editors.
He's a pretty smart guy. He's a brilliant guy.
We'll go with him.
He said, holding a cup of coffee. John, about drinking water, how about San Pellegrino water or Perrier water? Is that okay? I don't know.
I do.
I don't know.
My eye doctor said, yes, it hydrates you, but to a certain amount. It's not enough.
How is it? Okay, but I'm sorry. That's bubble water. It's still water. It must be 100% okay. There can't be much difference, right?
She just said, yeah, it hydrates you, but she wasn't enthusiastic about it. No.
Well, because probably regular water is every bit as efficacious, right? John, thanks for the book recommendation, Bill Bryson's The Body. Amazon brought it to me last week. My husband hears tidbits on and off in the evening. I thought he'd be annoyed by all of this, but he's not! !
Give him a week.
I was wondering if my staff here at the radio station can say the same. Or my wife, for that matter. Every now and then I'll go, you know, Brenda, if you flattened out your lungs, it'd be equivalent to the square footage of a tennis court. And she just goes on about her day. It's 11:30 on WGN Radio. The ALS Ice Bucket Challenge remembered with some really heartfelt stories. I'm just reading this text message here. It says, John, overhydration changes the electrolyte balance, your potassium, etc. And that can be a real problem. And then somebody...
Well, there was the marathon runner several years ago who drowned.
Oh,
right?
My gosh, that's right.
Yeah.
Somebody else texted in, for your ongoing water discussion, a friend of mine's cardiologist put her on water restriction because her 8 glasses a day of water routine had depleted her sodium level into the danger zone. If you have so much water, then your pH balance or whatever, your sodium balance is off, and you got to be mindful of that too. And then somebody else said, hey, John, I'm a, how did this person describe himself? Somebody said they were some sort of nutritionist and that there's no magic number of the amount of ounces of water you should be consuming. Like everybody says, okay, if I hit 8, I'm good. If I do 10,000 steps, I'm good. Bryson said in his book, I mentioned this yesterday, and I will again to you sometime if I see you randomly on the street, 10,000 steps, there's no magic number to that. There's no ha-ha-ha moment where you're now healthier. Walking more is better than not walking at all, but there's no magic number, nothing you especially achieve when you get to 10,000. In fact, he said if you do 2,200 steps a day, if you get a mile in a day, that'll be better than the average person by a long shot. So we were talking about this earlier. Ella, help me with this now. The winner of the hip-hop show at the Dickens Classic is on line one. And we are, or we are not, line one. Tim, you're on WGN Radio. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Good, how are you, sir?
Good, thanks for calling. Q Brothers Christmas Carol, the hip-hop twist on the Charles Dickens Classic, is at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. Have you been there before?
I have been there probably about 5 years ago.
It's a great venue, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've got some tickets for you. Say hi to Elif. Make sure we get your shoe size and all the right information. And have a great time. Bring a friend, okay?
She's very thorough.
Yeah, she certainly is. Tim, thanks for listening.
Thank you so much.
Okay, have a good day. Elif, I'll put him back on hold. and I'll pick up the phone with Julie Sharp. Hi, Julie. It's John Williams. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm great. How are you doing today?
Good. You're the president and CEO of the ALS Association's Greater Chicago Chapter. I want to make sure I get Peter's last name correctly. Is it Frades?
It is Frades, yes.
Pete Frades, yeah. I'm just reading a short story in the Boston Globe. Pete Frades was looking for a fastball as he stood at the plate in a men's league game one August evening in 2011. The pitch struck his left wrist. The lingering injury led to a diagnosis months later of, and now, how do you say, the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, is that it?
That's correct.
Also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The devastating news left him determined to help find a cure, even if it arrived too late to save him. He died on Monday at the age of 34 in his Beverly home, though his work helped raise millions of dollars by popularizing the Ice Bucket Challenge. His impact on ALS research will be felt for generations. So were you with the organization when this all happened?
I sure was. It was an amazing time for the individuals living with ALS and their families. For many of you, you may know that it's a degenerative neuromuscular disease. And over time, one of the aspects that can be affected is you lose your voice. And so for a less well-known disease that affects, you know, only about 15,000 individuals annually, he brought worldwide recognition, and we were the talk of the world for about 5 months, which is just amazing and such a gift to the ALS community. For those who are part of it and involved in it, one of the things we hear over and over is how come folks don't know about ALS and how devastating it is. And Pete and another gentleman, Pat Flynn, and another individual really brought it to the forefront, and everyone was partaking. There were over 17 million ice bucket challenges that occurred during that time frame. And believe me, we partook in quite a few of them here.
Yeah.
And it was a rallying cry for the community and for the world to come together to understand this disease.
A couple of my listeners reminded me that I guess the way it works is if you, I challenge you, and if you don't write a check, then you have to dump the water on, or somebody will dump ice on your head. But pretty much everybody who dumped the ice bucket on themselves or had it done to them wrote a check out. Everybody was just having fun with it and calling out other people to do the same, right?
Absolutely. And it was such a wonderful time for our families, too, because they were taking the opportunities to gather at their homes. And ALS can also be an isolating disease. So for the world to come together and their friends and their families and to have that sense of joy while all having ice dumped on you, and let me tell you, it is cold, and you were never prepared for that bucket of ice to hit you. It was just such a galvanizing, wonderful experience for the families.
Yeah.
And it raised a tremendous amount of money, which has had a huge impact, as you said, in the research development. 5 new genes have been developed. There's been a 50% increase in the clinics that are sponsored by the ALS Association, which allows for access to patients who can have, life-altering, quality-enhancing treatments.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. By the way, though, before we get to that, I saw in this Boston Globe story, I don't know if anybody's really able to say exactly how much money was donated, because maybe some of that money was going to come in anyway, but they estimated that it was over $220 million went to ALS research as a result. Does that number sound about right?
It sure does.
That's just amazing.
And yeah, it's but, you know, it takes about $1.5 billion to bring any treatment to market, if you will, from a drug perspective. So while the $220 million was an incredible gift and far beyond anybody's wildest dreams, it truly is, to hate to use the pun, a drop in the bucket to getting therapies and a true cure and understanding the disease. So.
Well, and I saw something recently about the problem of that, and that is, A lot of Americans have diabetes. A lot of Americans have asthma. A lot of Americans have things that if I came up with a drug, I would be able to get rich because everybody would take it. But if I have something as awful as, say, ALS, if enough people don't need it, then it'll always be hard for me to make back that $1.5 billion. So as a result of that, I either have to make the drug wildly expensive, which makes it inaccessible, or I just don't develop the drug because there's no profit motive, and therefore it's inaccessible. So it's kind of a catch-22 for somebody like you, isn't it?
It sure is. I will say one of the things we were able to help bring to market was an FDA guidance document, which is the first ever document that helps influence drug development and trials and access and more. It also has allowed us to invest in helping bring different types of research companies to the table with different discussions, and maybe there's already drugs sitting on a shelf that for one reason or another just haven't been brought to market, and maybe they just need help getting it past that goalpost. And, you know, what's already sitting out there that can make a huge difference? And you are correct, but at the same time, there are some amazing things that are happening, and there's ways that you can look at targeting certain genes that may make it more accessible down the road. It may be different types of ALS, too, not just like cancer. There's many different types of cancer that have been discovered. There's not just one form of ALS. So finding out what those biomarkers are, what those genes are, and then going in and maybe looking at technologies and therapies that can then go in and target, maybe we'll have, we will, I'm not going to say maybe, we will have therapies on the horizon and treatments on the horizon. I'm very encouraged. I've been in this role now for nearly 14 years, and what has been happening in the research arena is just remarkable. And a real catalyst in that was the ice bucket, which brought it to the forefront of, you know, the physicians and the clinicians and the researchers.
I had a question about where that is right now. I'm going to take a quick commercial break and come back with you. Let's finish this conversation on the other side. I'm also glad that you mentioned, too, how isolating an illness like this can be. I guess any of them can be, but maybe this particularly. And the idea that we were all now acting silly and having fun and raising money and not celebrating this disease, but at least recognizing these different people and saying they're out there and we're supporting you in the craziest way we can, and maybe the most important way we can. I never thought about it in those terms. I'm glad you reminded us of that as well. Julie Sharps with the ALS Association here in Illinois. So just one last question then about what kind of research is going on. Are we looking for a pill? Are we looking for a procedure? Let's finish this conversation in a minute.
For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad brag. Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Immortal words of legendary Yankees first baseman Lou Gehrig, the disease ALS named after him, of course, particularly after he gave that speech, described why his numbers had fallen off and what he was going through. By the way, another part about Lou Gehrig's speech, this is, they usually cut it there. What he said next, I think, was really, really good.
When you look around, wouldn't you consider it privilege to associate yourself with such a fine-looking man as is standing in uniform in this ballpark today?
The other players were lined up along the line, and so while it was about him, he then sort of doffed his cap to them and said, you know, these are some swell fellas here, too. What a thoughtful thing to say. And then at the end of the speech, he said this.
That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you.
Awful lot to live for. But it is terminal. And Pete Frates, the man who popularized the Ice Bucket Challenge, has passed away. At the age of 34, just a last minute with Julie Sharp from the association here in Illinois. Julie, I'm sure you've heard that speech more than once, huh?
I sure have. And every time, it still resonates. It's Doesn't been over it 80 years now since he stood in the mound and shared the with the world.
Julie, as the president and CEO of the ALS Association of Greater Chicago Chapter, just one last quick thing before we go. If I wanted to make a donation to your organization, I suppose there's an easy way to do it at your website, right?
Yes, there sure is, which is ALSAChicago.org, and there's a donate button right there, and you can make a huge impact in the lives of individuals living with ALS. We really do focus on living with ALS as opposed to dying from ALS. I know that that's semantics, but it really can change an individual's mindset, because there are some really great quality of life enhancing technologies and therapies now. And just as he said, he looked around and saw all those fine folks, so many of the individuals that we serve and that we care for and consider it a privilege to walk alongside of. They have such tremendous courage. And, if you could emulate so many of these individuals and the courage it takes every day to get up and to live with ALS and to focus on the positive.
Yeah, I guess that's the way we regard HIV and AIDS, right? I don't know that we have a cure for it per se, but people are able to live natural lives now, even though they're so afflicted. If we were so fortunate as to come up with something for the various forms of ALS, then that's not semantics at all. I think that's a worthwhile goal. Good luck to you guys on that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we're going to find it. We're going to make it happen. Yeah. And, again, when you were talking earlier about the isolation, I just want to say you brought so much joy and smile after smile to the folks who enjoyed watching all the ice bucket challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I went back and was researching a little bit about that. And I said to my producer, I said, Elif, we did one, right? And then I looked it up on our website and I couldn't find the video, but I did it with my dog Bingo. Bingo and I poured, I had a little tiny ice bucket, I guess, and I poured it on little Bingo's head. And I don't know what the point of that was. I don't know that Bingo loved it or certainly understood. Maybe the idea was that I was calling out other dog owners to make a donation as well or something. But we all took our turn, and it's never too late to help out. Well, good luck to you, Julie. Thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you so much. And the Frady family is in our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah.
What an impact he made in this world and still will be making.
Julie Sharp, President and CEO of the ALS Association, Greater Chicago Chapter. Have a good day, Julie. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. You bye-bye. Bet.
Take care. 11:51. Our news click is something more frivolous today. Go to WGNradio.com or the John Williams page on Facebook. I'm WGN King John there. Yesterday, American Airlines refused to board a woman until she took off her Hail Satan t-shirt. American Airlines did the right thing. American Airlines did the wrong thing. Kind of close. American Airlines did the wrong thing, 57%. 43% said, yeah, don't let that lady on a plane with a t-shirt that says Hail Satan. And then underneath, the way college shirts are sometimes, it says Established 666. So that's, and she was a Satanist or something like that. She had some belief and she was all on Team Satan. So that's fine. She gets to fly. I don't want her to fly the plane, right? So if your pilot has one of those, or if it's Satan Airlines, I'm not getting on that. But if the person sitting next to you, has that, I think they get to fly. I don't think you get to tell them to take that off. But they did. Her husband had, I guess, a couple of shirts or sweaters on, so he peeled something off and gave it to her. And so then she was able to still fly. But she was upset about it, and she told American Airlines, and they apologized. They did not give her a voucher.
She told them to go to hell?
That was a pretty fun joke. Laid it right out there for you, Steve, and I didn't even see it coming. that reminds me a little bit of this sort of conundrum that Walmart found themselves in. Talk about inappropriate things on a shirt. This is the Walmart stores, I guess, in Canada. And they had a blue, I think it was, sweatshirt that you could get at Christmas. And it has Santa Claus there. And in front of them is a table. and there are three lines of cocaine lined up in front of Santa, and then a little pile of cocaine, and it's, you know, one of these sort of cheap-looking sweatshirts with a funny image or saying on it, and then it says, "Let it snow." You get it? Let it snow.
And Walmart was selling those?
Yeah, online.
Wow. And online, okay.
And they apologized. They said, "We apologize for any unintended offense this may have caused." I guess some Coke dealers would think that was really funny, but mostly I think people would take offense to that.
I wonder how many stores or what kind of things they sell online that they would never put in their stores.
That's the problem. They have a portal, and they sell third-party vendor products on their site. And then when they catch things that are inappropriate, they take it down. I don't know if somebody at Walmart first saw it and said, okay, but certainly after the complaints came through, they have since taken it down. It reminds me a little bit of that Amazon incident earlier this month, right? It was in December, or maybe late November. A third-party seller was putting the Auschwitz concentration camp Christmas ornaments online. You could buy Auschwitz Christmas ornaments, which, when I looked at, they weren't as ghastly as it sounds. That is, there's all kinds of trinkets you get from places like that. Calendars, snow globes, bottle. They had a bottle opener, for crying out loud. I would not have sold those. I would not have put those on my website. But it was a picture of Auschwitz, like you would have on a card, say. You could remember it, you know, in the appropriate way you're supposed to remember your visit there. I wouldn't hang it on my tree. In this case, Walmart has taken down the sweater with the drug reference. I don't know if they didn't know or if they didn't catch it, but I would certainly take that one down. I do let the lady with the T-shirt sit next to me on an airplane, though. Our news click is a little divided on that. It's 57:43. The impeachment hearings are proceeding. There are two counts. Steve Bertrand, we've got the news coming up at the top of the hour. I guess our news click will be something about that today. We haven't touched on the impeachment proceedings, but it appears almost certain that the president is going to be impeached. The question is, will the Senate convict? And I think we all know how that's going to go. In Studio D, she's getting ready for the business lunch. What's coming up?
Hey, John. We have a lot coming up, especially we're excited to have CEO and president of Wintrust Mortgage, David Hrobin, in studio. And he's going to be telling us a lot about housing policies and why home ownership still matters.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. I wanted to weigh in on your sparkling water conversation. I think sparkling water actually makes me thirstier.
Really? You know, I'm going to get a water expert on the show tomorrow to answer these questions.
And also, LaCroix is addictive.
Maybe that's a bad thing. Tomorrow's show, I will address that. You have a good one here.
Thanks.